Good morning, Reality Church. My name is Travis Carson. I am the student pastor here, and I get to kick off our series, The Intentionals. Man, I don't know about that video. Gosh, I got to watch it a few times, and I feel like that's a lot to follow after, you know. Let me tell you guys about the Bible. No, it's going to be great. I was definitely brought up in the church. I was definitely one of those people you would call a church kid. And I know for me, though, anything from the Old Testament was always kind of weird. You know, that was kind of like, you know, little bit further down the chain for me. You know, I sat down, I was like, all right, what am I reading my Bible? Lamentations? Ooh, John. I know a guy named John. That's much better. You know, something about like the Old Testament would seem just so kind of disconnected from where I was. The Old Testament, it was actually, a lot of it is history. The Old Testament covers a span of, you know, a couple thousand years versus the New Testament, which covers, you know, less than a century. And these characters, I mean, they might as well been from a galaxy far, far away for how just different these guys felt. You know, maybe if they all got a sweet video introduction like that, I'd like it a little bit better. But they're kind of like museum pieces, you know, like when you hear George Washington. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that, you know, stern face, maybe he's crossing the Delaware. I don't know. But that's who anybody from the Old Testament was to me, was just this, you know, museum piece. But again, some of you guys might remember this. If you went to church or Sunday school at any time during the 80s to the mid-90s, every now and then you'd go into Sunday school class and there'd be an easel. And waiting on this easel was something after last service, someone told me they'd never seen one of these before. I'll kind of hope you guys can see it over there. Oh, this is, oh, it's not coming. The flannel graph. Now, yes. Bringing it back. So today, we're not using PowerPoint, we're using this. No. But the flannel graph, man, this thing was like, I mean, this was it. I mean, this brought all of my Bible stories to life in stunning two dimensions. And every time the teacher got to move a little piece in there, it was so, so exciting. But like, you know, the characters, I mean, they could have just used the same guy like every week, and I wouldn't have been able to tell the difference between, like, you know, Moses to Elijah to Nahum or whoever else. I mean, they're all guys with beards. They're all a bunch of white guys, which was kind of weird to me. I figured out later on it didn't really seem right. But all these guys with, you know, this look, I mean, again, this is something that, again, they brought it. It's like, oh, wow, yes, the flannel graph is coming out. And it gave the characters a little bit more dimension, but still, that's kind of what they were, though, was just these static, you know, figures. Sorry, I got to cover this because I know myself this would be a distraction to me the whole time. Be looking at that flying cow, if I were you. But the Old Testament, though, I mean, it had these miracles. I mean, yeah, New Testament had some pretty significant miracles, too, but the Old Testament had, you know, creation, like a word, and everything came into being, a worldwide flood, a pillar of fire and smoke that was leading the Israelites through the wilderness, marching around a city until the walls fell down, people turning into the pillars of salt. I mean, this stuff, I knew that these stories were important. I knew that these super holy, super godly men mattered, but I could never really figure out why or how. And over the next several weeks or this summer, we're going to be doing this intentional series where we're going to be taking kind of a snapshot of about 10 different characters from the Old Testament. You know, and the thing to remember about these guys and gals, that these people, they were human. They were flesh and blood, just like us. Like Solomon got hungry. You know, Moses probably had gas. You know, David probably stubbed his toe on something walking around. Rahab had a bad hair day, and I'm sorry, she's the only gal I had to pick on that. But you know, it's important for me to reference that these people, while we hear extraordinary stories about them, how amazing things happen, in reality, God chose these ordinary people and did extraordinary things through them. God chose people with faults, with hurts, with inadequacies, with scars. And God chose these people and used them intentionally because that's just the kind of God he is. He's in the business of redeeming, of restoring, of reconciling, of repairing. I know in this room, just like Josh says, that we are a unique collection of broken and messed up people. You got one right here you're listening to this morning. I know that's real encouraging, right? That's what I want to hear when we go to church on Sundays. But people who have had regrets, who have messed up, who've hurt others and been hurt themselves. And as time passes, I know that these hurts, these scars that we carry, yeah, they fade a little bit. We tend to not have the same edge to them, but every now and then they come creeping up on us and we wonder, God, like, why did I go through that? God, how can you use me in my brokenness? the series now too, guys, there's some of these stories, it's going to be so easy to read them and hear them and look at them like, oh, well, that's me. I'm like, you know, David, and I got to go get some stones and I can take on any giant as long as God's with me. And I think that's always the way we want to pull, but rather these stories aren't so much about us, but it's about God showing us who he is through these people. How God, not that he used people in spite of their scars, but he used people because of their scars. And this morning we're starting out with this guy named Elijah, who just, if you look at his story from beginning to end, he definitely stands out as a superhuman man. I mean, if you guys know anything about his backstory, if you don't, we'll get into a little bit of it here today. But actually, he has a really no backstory whatsoever. He just kind of shows up in the Bible. And the real crux of his story, the part we're going to be talking about, kind of comes a little bit later on. So we're going to kind of move quickly through Elijah's story. We're going to be in 1 Kings, I think starting in chapter 17, going through 19 this morning. So if you guys got your tablets, your phones, or if you're watching online, you got the internet Bible right there, so you can use that. But yeah, so we're being in 1 Kings. There's actually a sequel to a couple other books, 1 and 2 Samuel, where we're tracing the lineage of the kingship, how after King David died, how Solomon was king, and after Solomon died, there was a whole series of evil, mostly evil kings who took control. This guy named Ahab was one that was the king at the time during Elijah, and this guy was a particularly nasty, evil fellow. He followed the worship of Baal. Him and his queen Jezebel led Israel away from God. Some other kings did this too, but into this worship of Baal. And sometimes, guys, when we read these stories, like, oh, you know, they're a bunch of, you know, just kind of primitive humans bowing down to a statue because they thought that's what made, you know, the rain come. But really, guys, that there was a lot more to Baal worship than just bowing down to a statue. If they made, like, you know, a summer blockbuster movie about this and, you know, showed us everything that went into Baal practices, you would walk out of that theater. I mean, it was just bloody mutilation. I mean, they would cut themselves. They would involve, like, temple prostitution, copulation with animals, child sacrifice. Jezebel and Ahab kind of brought this to a new height in Israel. And it's not that all nation of Israel, because sometimes we read this again, we think, oh, these people were just, you know, frothing madmen who sat around all day doing this horrific stuff. Well, no, I mean, they were normal people. They had day-to-day life stuff. But as a whole, the nation, the government of Israel had embraced this. They turned away from the God of their ancestors and followed this worship in Baal. And so that's when Elisha just appears in 17:1. It says, Elisha, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead. I mean, that's pretty much saying, like, now Travis of Omaha in Nebraska. I mean, we don't know anything about this guy, really. But except for his name, though, too, Elijah, actually the name itself means that Yahweh is my God. Like, just his name by itself and his time and place and culture is making a statement, okay? Yahweh is my God. That was the Hebrew name for God. And so Elijah 17:1, it says, he told King Ahab, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, the God that I serve, there will be no dew or rain during the next few years until I give the word. Now, he wasn't just picking something random here. Baal was actually the fertility god. Baal was in charge of making the rains come and crops grow and new life. And so Elijah intentionally picked a power, something that their God was supposed to be pretty good with, and showing that he really didn't have that much power at all. And essentially after this, Elijah goes on the lam. He was told by God to go and hide himself at a brook by a place called Cherith. You guys probably have heard the story before when Elijah, ravens came and fed him. And it was, I've heard whole sermons and a whole sermon done on this before, but this isn't where we're staying today. From Cherith, he moved on to another town called Zarephath, where he met a widow. And I think about 2 months ago, I think Lance did a sermon about what happened at Zarephath, how, you know, she had just a handful of flour and a little bit of oil, and how God supernaturally provided in that time. But again, we are moving on a little bit further. And so there, it's been about 3.5 years since rain has fallen. I mean, this is, if you could imagine, I mean, when we have dry seasons around here, things get pretty tense, I know, for farmers and such. But so 3.5 years of no rain. This is pretty crazy. And so God told Elijah, pretty much the time for hiding is over. Go and present yourself to King Ahab and tell him that I will soon send rain. Now, during this time, it's not a good time to be a prophet of the Lord. If we read in 1 Kings, it says how Jezebel is actually going around hunting down and massacring these prophets. A couple of them had gotten away and hidden. But Elijah, these guys knew that he was responsible for this. So when they first, when Ahab and Elijah first meet again, the first thing Ahab does is start calling Elijah a troublemaker. You did this, man. You stop the rain and you go off and you hide. I can guarantee you guys that during that time, Baal's prophets were definitely calling out to their God. And I'm going to guarantee you guys that their resolve and anger against Elijah was hardening. And here's what comes down to be the kind of what we know Elijah for. He told Ahab, he responded with a challenge. He says, "Now summon to all of Israel to join me at Mount Carmel." And I had a misspell earlier that said caramel. It's not caramel, it's Carmel, okay? Along with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who are supported by Jezebel. Another translation says who eat at Jezebel's table, meaning that he was like, yeah, your government is supporting these people. They're feeding from your very table. And so at Mount Carmel, again, it hasn't rained in those 3 years, and it's Elijah versus these essentially 850 pagan prophets, and they make this kind of deal that they're both going to build an altar, and they're both going to put a sacrifice on it. They're going to call out to their God. Elijah will call out to his God, and we'll see which God answers in fire. And so he gives the prophets the home field advantage. They pick the bull. They go first, and it says they went from morning to noon, frothing and cutting themselves, but there was no voice and no one answered. And if Elijah, it's kind of funny, if you read it, like he was actually kind of like goading them on during this. He was, you know, suggesting, well, maybe your God is relieving himself, which is, you know, kind of hilarious. You suggested their God is in the bathroom. Or maybe he's away, or maybe he's asleep. And so it said they cut themselves and they danced more. They raved all afternoon until the time of the evening sacrifice, but there was no sound, no reply, no response. And then Elijah, I remember the flannel graph story of this because my tutor, Elijah, he says he repaired an altar of the Lord. He took these 12 stones and built this altar and put the wood on it and cut up the bull and put the bull on it. And then he asked for a jug of water. He pours a jug of water over it, another jug. He pours four jugs of water over top of the sacrifice. There's actually a little trench he digs around it that fills up as well. And so definitely he's showing these guys like, okay, I have a soaking wet sacrifice here. We'll see what happens. And then Elijah, like the cool, calm, collected Bible hero he is, you know, probably just very solemnly walked up and prays. He says, "Oh Lord, God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob, prove today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant. Prove that I have done all this at your command. Oh Lord, answer me. Answer me so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have brought them back to yourself." Immediately, God responds. Immediately, the fire of the Lord flashed down from heaven and burned up the young bull. Now, some people, I was reading back and forth, like, well, it wasn't really fire, it was lightning. I don't care what it is. If something can come down from the sky on command and burn up the bull, the wood, the stones, the dust, even lick up all the water in the trench, that's kind of unusual for me, okay? It doesn't matter if it's fire or lightning. And when all the people saw it, they fell face down on the ground and cried out, "The Lord is God. Yes, the Lord is God." Guys, imagine me, put yourself in the scene. Like, I remember we were on vacation one time and like lightning like struck a tree right by our car. I mean, you feel a concussion blast. If you saw lightning or fire just consume water and even lick it out of the trench, I mean, that's going to leave an impact on you, okay? Like, if you imagine if you were one of those prophets of Baal, who's like, you're all beat up and bloody and like, oh man, that's all it took? I mean, this is ridiculous. What are we doing? I mean, the Bible, I mean, if this was like a paperback novel, you know, this whole scene was about like a page and a half, or if you were reading like in a comic book, it would have been like a couple more panels. But don't like just glance over, which was a huge monumental event here. It says Elijah, probably assuming with the help of the others, I don't think I have a slide of this, but it says he said to, this is in verse 40, he said, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let a single one escape." And so the people seized them and slaughtered them all. They took them to a nearby valley and cut them up, which is, again, not Elijah, just he's not in like ultra violence. That's actually, he was following what Mosaic law told him was supposed to happen to these guys. I got some references from Deuteronomy. If you really want them, I'll tell you later. But this was not just like an ordinary day in the Old Testament. If you can imagine being in that mountain, I mean, the king is there, all these prophets, all these people watching. Just imagine that feeling in the air, the murmur that's going through the crowd. Things were changing. Oh my goodness, like we just saw like that we've been misled all this time. And then all of a sudden they smell that faint smell of ozone in the air. After this, Elijah told Ahab, it's in 1841, he says, like, "I hear a mighty rainstorm coming." He told him, "I want to get in your chariot and get going." Ahab's palace is in this town called Jezreel, which is about 20 to 40 miles away from where they're at on Mount Carmel there. The sky turned black with clouds, and a heavy wind brought the first rainfall they'd had in 3.5 years. And again, kind of one of those weird little details in there, but somehow Elijah runs to Jezreel faster than what Ahab's chariots can carry him. And so there, guys, man, imagine what this is like for Elijah. This is huge. Like, oh my goodness, like the king saw this. And the king, kind of like I am, when I get home, I love telling my wife about everything that happened. And so Ahab goes and he tells, you know, Jezebel about what he had just experienced, that all this time, we've been wrong, that those prophets we've been supporting, these guys were frauds. There is no Baal. We've seen that he's a silent God. We saw the God who answered the fire. Oh, don't worry about the prophets. Elijah took care of them. We got their bodies stacked up in a valley nearby here. I mean, for Elijah too, I mean, the rain was falling for the first time in 3.5 years. Man, revival was coming for Israel. I mean, the king saw it. Surely him and the royal court and his queen, they would be convinced of the true power of God. And so Ahab tells Jezebel, and she sends a message to the man who exposed the lie of Baal worship and the glory of Yahweh. She sends a message to Elijah. She says, may the gods strike me and even kill me if by this time tomorrow I have not killed you just as you killed them. She's referring to her prophets there, the people that she was in support of. Man, for Elijah, this is that punch in the gut. You know, that unexpected phone call that comes in the middle of the night, the thing that takes the breath right out of you. I mean, Elijah, who had witnessed unbelievable miracles from God, who's brought back to life a dead child, who was fed by ravens at a brook, who was led and kept safe by God for 3.5 years while other prophets were hunted down, who did the miracle of the oil and the water, who brought down fire from the sky. This man, who has no reason to doubt the power or sovereignty of God, runs from an angry woman. Now, here you could insert your favorite angry woman joke. I heard someone already has one back there. I'm not gonna do that because I'm smart like that. I think I'm smart. But so, you know, he ran far to the south to a place called Beersheba. This is actually in, like I said, in Judah. Israel's the northern kingdom. Judah's now the southern kingdom. And even further than Judah into the wilderness. It says, then he went alone into the wilderness, traveling all day. He sat down under a solitary broom tree and prayed that he might die. Now, again, this is a quick progression for us. You know, anytime it's like, oh yeah, he traveled a super long distance. You know, when I read, like, you know, Lord of the Rings, or actually The Hobbit, it's like all they did was walk, and they walk, and they walk, and they walk, and they walked. And you know, that's just like a couple of pen strokes, but this was like a lot of time that Elijah had, the beginning of even a longer journey that he had with these thoughts, this depression that was creeping in and overtaking him. I mean, this guy, he's seen what his prayers can do, okay? He's seen his prayers stop rain and bring down fire, and now he's praying that he might die. He says, I have had enough, Lord. Lord, I've had enough. And since he's saying that, I can't take this anymore, God. The work is stressful. It's exhausting. It was pointless. I've had enough. Take my life, for I am no better than my ancestors who have already died. Here, Elijah, he's seeing his own failures, and he's connecting it to his own sinfulness, his own imperfection. He sets the blame on his own unworthiness. And so Elijah here, he expected that the nation would turn around after what happened there on the mount, but instead, he forgot that the people are going to reject God. And people are going to reject God despite the evidence for God, not because of the evidence. People reject God not despite the evidence, not because of the evidence. And carrying that burden of the faith of the nation and all the hearts of his people, it was too much for him. And so the Bible tells us that he fell down and went to sleep. But while he was sleeping, an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. And he looked around, and there beside his head was some baked bread on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate, drank, and lay down again. Again, this is weird to me, okay? Like, if you woke up in the middle of the desert and there's an angel with, like, a primitive easy-bake oven making you a loaf of bread, I mean, that's kind of like, that's a kind of a big deal. I don't think, I at least think I would have had a conversation, but he just rolls over and falls back to sleep. You know, in verse 7, later on, he kind of does the same thing again. Later on in the New Testament, James writes about Elijah. They're talking about prayer, and he says he had to remind his people then that Elijah, this is in James 5:17, he was human just as we are. Elijah was not from beyond this world. If you guys look at the way Elijah actually leaves this world and a couple of things that happened, people thought that he was someone from beyond this. He was more than just a man. But there's a very real physical, chemical, material part of who we are. You know, recently I heard a thing on Facebook where someone was told that depression was a result of their lack of faith, that they're not relying on God. That essentially, their anxiety, your doubts, your depression stem from you, again, not relying on God enough. And that's something, guys, I have to disagree with. Well, we know Elijah, this guy spent a lot of time with God. He spent a lot of time in prayer. And we know that the prayer, it changes things. It affects things. It'll sustain our spirit. But guys, we are so much more than just spirit. Here, Elijah, he needed rest and food. I mean, likewise, we would say that there's problems in this world. And yes, we pray for things like world hunger. But if that was a solution for world hunger, was just to close ourselves up in a room and pray, that would be so much easier. I mean, it would be fixed, right? But things like that, it requires resources and food and funding for these organizations that go out and do these works. God, he remembers that we are frail. I'm sorry I don't have this. This is from Psalms 103, verse 14. It says, "For he knows how weak we are. He remembers that we are only dust." God, he knows our frame. He knows that we're but dust, and he's mindful that our material bodies need to be taken care of often before our spiritual selves can be in the right place. The second time that the angel fed him, he said, "Arise." This is from, I actually don't have the reference, I'm sorry. But it says, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." I don't know how many of you have been in a place like that in your own life. And so Elijah, after he ate and drank, he said he got up and traveled for another 40 days. He only had about 200 miles to go, but still he spent a long time, you know, like, you remember like the family circus route you see in the comics? I imagine that's what he was doing. He went to Mount Sinai, which you guys probably know that's where Moses encountered God at. This was a special holy mountain to them. And after the journey, still deep into his depression, he crawls into a cave there. But the Lord said to Elijah, the Lord said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" I mean, God, he already, don't you love when in the Bible God asks questions? I mean, God already knows the answer to this. But for Elijah, this was good. It gave him a chance to unburden his heart, to speak freely to God. Elijah replied that, "I have zealously served the Lord. God, I've faithfully served you. Look at the danger it put me in. But the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you. They tore down your altars. They killed every one of your prophets. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too. I am all alone." Like, we know that this isn't accurate. Again, from in there, we read about this guy he encountered named Obadiah, it's an O name, I'm messing it up. But he told him that he'd been actually hiding these prophets and putting them in caves and feeding him. But the thing is that discouraging times can make us feel more isolated and alone than we really are. Even the fact that he's saying that they're trying to take his life, and he just previously prayed that he might die. I mean, if he really believes that he's the last prophet of God, if he's the last one that can save this nation, this is the most unreasonable thing ever, to think that I just want to die and just be done with it. It shows the unreasonable nature of panic and fear and despair and depression. And so God responds to him, "Go out and stand before me on the mountain," the Lord told him. And as Elijah stood there, the Lord passed by. And a mighty windstorm hit the mountain. It was such a terrible blast that the rocks were turned loose, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, there was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. God brought his presence before Elijah to show him first where he was not. I mean, I know for me, sometimes like we look for God in these just dramatic manifestations. We want something big. We want a sign. Like, I remember my friend Sam in junior high. I remember him saying how he would pray and ask God to help him use the force just one time to turn off his light switch from his bed with. And he said it happened one time too. And I don't believe that he would make that up. But still, it seems a bit out there that that's how God's going to show up, by letting us use the force. But certainly, guys, God, he sometimes appears in such big ways, like what Elijah had experienced, you know, these dramatic displays. But after the fire, there was the sound of a gentle whisper. The dramatic display on Carmel didn't change the nation. What happened to the prophets of Baal? That didn't teach anyone a lesson. I think it's from your own experience. I mean, think about your own experience of people preaching about God's anger and God's judgment and what God hates. It doesn't change anybody's heart. Laws and legislations and protests, Facebook statuses and rants and likes and shares do not move anybody's heart closer to God. Instead, it's the still small voice of God that speaks to the human heart that is actually more convincing and powerful than any of these displays that what they saw up there on the mount. It says, when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. You know, he was showing his humility here. It also makes you think of like when you see people like, you know, celebrity gets busted, you know, what do? They cover their face because they know that they're without course, that they are guilty. He knows he was going in the presence of God, and a voice said, what are you doing here, Elijah? And again, Elijah went through and repeated the exact same thing he said earlier, how everything that was going wrong. And I know in my own life, like Elijah, I've cast myself as my main character. And we all do this. You know, my needs, man, these are real needs. My wants, these would be nice, but my burdens, my stress, my scars, I mean, these are things I carry with me, and they affect how I see everything. My family, my children, my legacy, you know, like, I believe that the God is eternal, but to me, it's like I need to leave a mark. I want to know that I was important, there was a reason, that I had a purpose, that I have a purpose. For Elijah, he had forgotten. Or maybe he was just too muddled to remember what it was. Elijah had forgot what he was supposed to do, and he fell into a dark, dark place. And again, like Elijah, we all lose that focus, that purpose. That we feel that our life is pointless, that our job is going nowhere, that our spouse will never change, that our kids won't behave or act or do what the other kids are supposed to be doing. In fact, that we can't even change ourselves, that our own addictions and stumbling blocks that we can't get past. I mean, what's the point? I know a lot of us have that moment where we ask God that was it? That's it, God. After everything in my life, after everything I've given up, after everything I've went through, this was what it was all for. Those moments where you feel the enemy is close behind you, and just like Elijah, we want nothing more but to crawl off into a cave and die. After all that, in time and place for Elijah's life where it looked like all of his struggles were pointless for nothing, is when God did his greatest work in Elijah's life. Spoke to him in that still small voice and reminded and encouraged him that this was not the end for him at all, that something more was coming. Then the Lord, he told him, go back the same way you came. I guess that's encouraging too, right? Go back the same way you came and travel to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive there, anoint Hazael to be king of Aram. Aram is actually part of like what Syria is. You're going to hear more about this guy coming up here in 2 Kings. But man, this is kind of a big deal to anoint a king. Again, this wasn't just something people just went around like, all right, you're next. I mean, this was like God's divine like seal, essentially saying that you have been selected. And then anoint Jehu, grandson of Nimshi, to be the king of Israel. That Ahab's days were numbered. I know for Elijah, it must have seemed that this is never going to change. But no, that there's a new king coming. And not only that, but you get to pick. You're going to show the nation that I'm telling you who it is to be. And anoint Elisha, not Jah, Shah, son of Shaphath from the town of Abel Meholah to replace you as my prophet. Guys, for Elijah, this is what he needed. This here, especially this second part here, this was hope for Elijah, saying, you know, one of the biggest complaints he made is that I am all alone. And God's like, no. You understand, there's someone, I'm getting ready for you right now. You're going to have a successor. You're going to have a friend. Even after you're gone and dead, this guy is going to carry on the work that you've been doing here. He goes on to say that anyone who escapes from Hazael will be killed by Jehu, and those who escape from Jehu will be killed by Elijah. Again, he's not appealing to Elijah's need to chop up people. He's saying that I am just, and I'm going to take care of all this stuff. It's off your shoulders. Yet I will preserve 7,000 others in Israel who have never bowed down to Baal or kissed him. And for this final encouragement for Elijah was telling him, you know what? While you think you're the only one left, I got this covered. There's lots and lots and lots and lots of prophets just like you who are out there. Yeah, some of them might be in hiding right now, but you are not alone. Indeed, your work as a prophet has been fruitful, and you've done good work. Charles Spurgeon, who He was like an early Baptist preacher. Some of you guys might have heard of him before. And I got in trouble. I'm going to say it again. I do think he kind of looks like Robert Kahn, just a little bit, when Robert has the full beard in. He says that this showed Elijah that his quiet ministry over the years actually bore more fruit than his spectacular ministry at Mount Carmel. The still small voice had been doing for Israel what Elijah could not do. For Elijah, this was hardly the end. I can almost imagine God talking to Elijah saying, Elijah, just because things didn't turn out the way you thought they should, it doesn't mean that I'm not God. Elijah, just because people aren't behaving and reacting and doing what you think they should be doing and behaving like, it doesn't mean that I'm not in control. Elijah, even though it seems that all is lost, that the enemy has won, this isn't the end. You, man of dust, I have so much more planned for you. I know for me, we'd just gotten married. We were married like a month and a half. We were getting ready to leave for a honeymoon the next day, and my work told me I had to come up for a meeting at 9 p.m. 9 p.m. meetings are never good, I learned. The gist of it was like, oh, we're closing the store down in 30 days, but don't worry about it. Go enjoy your honeymoon. And it's like, I'll be looking for a job in Mexico. That's gonna be fun while I'm down there. But no, at the time, you know, like, oh, I was like, you know, it was great. I was, you know, I had severance. I was going to take some time to kind of figure out what I wanted to do. So I wasn't kind of doing more of the same like I had been doing. But those days turned into weeks and weeks into months. And it was a really, really dark time in my life. I was newlywed and newly unemployed. And the feeling you have as being a husband, my wife, she works at the hospital. She goes for like about 13-hour shift. She's gone. And when you see your wife leaving for work and you're just moping around the house all day, it's a pretty crushing feeling. I mean, for the past 10 years for me, it's kind of been the exact same story. I kept losing my job for the same reason of like, you know, I was, you know, position eliminated, downsizing, store closing. I was not sleeping enough. I was drinking too much. It was winter, so it was literally dark all the time for me. We'd recently been returning to church, though. It'd been our first time in church in about 10 years. And it was one of those things where it's like, well, we're going to get married, and it's going to be awkward. Just go to a random pastor. Let's go to church. We'll find a pastor there. Funny how God works. I'd love to tell you my whole life story. Do it another time. But I had a, you know, the best way I can put it is that God would not leave me alone. Like, God would not leave me alone. And since I had so much free time, it seemed, I intentionally spent time just trying to get to know God again. And at the time, I had no idea what God was preparing for me. At the time, I had no idea about the people who would be coming into my life over the next several years. People who at that time were literally scattered across the country. I'm not saying that God brought all these people and orchestrated all this stuff into my life for my benefit, but rather God had prepared a place for me, and I had no idea, I had no way to see that it was coming. A place where I fit, a place where it gave me purpose, a place where I would be with other people like myself that had the same goal of making God's name known. You know, some of these people I'm talking about, they're my fellow staff members, both our volunteer and paid staff here. Some of them are friends that I just have. I mean, people that I'm meeting for the first time. It's like, man, I wish I would have known you, you know, 10 years ago. And it's like knowing people like you guys. I mean, you make me better. You make me stronger. You make me sharper. I'm encouraged by the lives of my friends and seeing God move and grow in them. And that's the thing. I realize that right now that I'm not always going to be in the perfect fit. I'm not always going to be, you know, in the center of God's will, as I think that's the church term for it. But there is work to be done. And with what I've been given, God told Elijah that he was nowhere close to being done with his work. He needed a task to focus on so he could get that focus off of his given very difficult circumstances he was going through and look outwards to what God was preparing for him. Elijah had these scars, a reminder of how he didn't have it in him. And God used those scars to spur him on to the next thing he had for him to do. And like Elijah, we need to be reminded too that you have a purpose. Every single person's room has a purpose. I've heard it said that you're made with a purpose, for a purpose, and on purpose. And I think it's so easy for us to lose that. You have a purpose. There is work yet to be done. And in my experience too, guys, I know that God does his very best work when I have nothing to do with it. When my hands are off, it's when God does his most work in me. I mean, guys, when you get right down to it, Elijah didn't make it stop raining. And Elijah didn't make it start raining again. Elijah didn't call fire down from heaven. God did that. Okay, Elijah, it wasn't the power in Elijah that brought a boy back to life or supernaturally fed a widow. God did that. I'm sure Elijah was praying to God, but his prayers were sensitive to God's leading. when Elijah was at his lowest, when all of his focus had turned inward, he was reminded of where it is we really find God. That still, small voice. You know, you have a purpose. And this is something that's even now, I forget all the time. Just recently, I had one of those nights where you're laying in bed and you're trying to sleep, but all you can do is think about all the other things that aren't right. And I don't know, like, I don't know if it's just something for the type of work I do, but I just have these moments. I'm like, is this even right for me? Like, do I even know what I'm doing? There's so many people that do it better. I've seen other youth groups that do this, other pastors that got way pointier hair than I got, or whatever. But seriously, though, like, am I connecting with these spirits of these students? Am I making a difference? Are they, is there something going on here that's beyond me that I'm just completely missing? It was this horrible, horrible feeling. I remember, like, it was a rough couple of days there, and I'm not joking, guys. It was 2 days later, came up here for our junior high youth group, and I get a little card from one of our seventh grade gals, which, again, I didn't think I had much influence or in with the seventh grade gals, but one thing she wrote me was, she said, "I appreciate what you do so much, so please never stop, because you've truly changed my life for the better. I could never ask for more." Now, when this seventh grade girl wrote this, she had no idea, like, what this was going to do for me. I really believe this girl was following that still small voice that said, "Hey, just write a little card." How often I would read and reread this, because I need encouragement. I need to be reminded. And I was reminded by this that there is still much work to be done, that I have a purpose. You know, I always want to know what's going to come up next. I always want to be prepared. I always want to be planning for God. Whatever's going to throw at me next, just you know, give me a heads up on it. But God doesn't always work like that. With Elijah, he told him exactly what he needed to know when he needed to know it. He didn't tell him to go to Cherith until he first went to Ahab. He didn't tell him to go to Zarephath until the brook dried up there where he was at. God led Elijah by faith one step at a time. I'm sure from the beginning, God could have told him, "Hey, here's everything that's coming. Okay, here's what you need to be prepared for." But I'm sure that would have nothing but overwhelm this man who was made of dust. Elijah carried with him scars of his failure to return the nation to God. He felt the burdens of Israel upon him. He thought that all had turned away, that he was the only one that was left, completely forsaken by God. But one day, he didn't know this, but another man was coming too. Another man who people would call prophet of God, a man who bore physical scars. And that man's physical scars prove, you're right, I can't do this on my own. This burden is too great. And nailed to a cross outside of Jerusalem, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, took the burden of it all. The wrath and anger of all sins of all times were poured out on Jesus Christ. And in that darkest moment of our history, when it seemed that evil had won, when the Son of God was hanging dying on a cross. And he calls out, "God, why did you forsake me?" And the sky was dark and the earth shook and rocks split. It was in that moment God's greatest work was done. Mankind was made right with God, and we had nothing to do with it. Because of that, there is much, much work to be done. You know, Elijah, he's an interesting character when we look at his whole thing. There's still more to his story in there. If you guys, I really encourage you to take a look at it. And some of us, like I say, we all have a purpose. We all have a calling. You know, God has wired up every single one of us for something. It's not all ministry, okay? Like, God has wired every one of us up in some unique way. You have a purpose. There's much work to be done.